Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight we discuss the history, therapeutic applications, and future of psychedelics in the U.S. 50 years after the criminalization of LSD, psychedelic therapy is undergoing a renaissance in the United States. Medical practitioners at UCLA, Johns Hopkins, and NYU in New York are exploring the therapeutic potential of these medications in treating mental health disorders such as addiction, PTSD, depression, and anxiety. Silicon Valley executives admit to microdosing daily with LSD to increase concentration, creativity, and positivity. And further underground, new converts explore psychoactive substances seeking connection and spiritual growth. But despite promising results and growing enthusiasm in the scientific community, the road to legalization remains uncertain. So tonight we ask, how are hallucinogens being used in psychotherapy today? And is America ready for the coming psychedelic psychotherapy revolution? Joining me by phone to discuss these issues is Dr. Charles Grobe, professor in the departments of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine and one of the country's leading clinical researchers of psychedelic-assisted therapy. Welcome, Charles. Let's see, hopefully we have Charles there. And I also want to welcome by phone, assuming we have Dr. Grobe, Don Latin, author of Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments, and the New Psychotherapy. He's also former longtime religion writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Ethan. Great to be on the show.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, and we'll open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. So, Dr. Grobe, I gather you're on the phone now. I wanted to welcome you officially to City Visions.
Yes, hi. Good to be with you.
Glad you're here, and I wanted to start with you. What kinds of drugs and chemicals are we talking about here? I gather there are a variety of natural and synthetic origins with these compounds, and I wanted you to explain for listeners what the universe of the drugs here that we're talking about.
There are a large number of plants in nature which contain hallucinogenic alkaloids, chemical compounds with hallucinogenic activity. A number of these have been synthesized. The ones that are most prominent in the recent generation of research are psilocybin, which was the active alkaloid isolated from mushroom psilocybe cubensis. And the other drug that's receiving a great deal of attention is MDMA, sometimes known as ecstasy or Molly. The chemical name is 3,4-methylenedeoxymethamphetamine.
And what about LSD?
Well, LSD was the most actively explored drug back in the 50s and 60s during the first generation of psychedelic research. It was the most widely explored out in the culture. However, in today's world, it is not part of active research investigations. There have been no clinical LSD studies in the U.S. since the early 70s, and I believe in Europe there have only been a handful. Most of the attention has been going to psilocybin, to MDMA, and also to ayahuasca, which is the Amazonian plant hallucinogen decoction, which our group studied back in the early 90s and in the early 2000s. And ayahuasca is the attention recently of some Brazilian psychiatric investigators who have conducted the first placebo control examination of the efficacy of ayahuasca in a population of treatment-resistant patients with depression.
And so I have to ask why LSD is not part of the scientific conversation. Is there a scientific reason for that?
Well, there's a scientific reason, and then there's maybe a cultural reason. Scientifically, let's say, LSD is a very long-acting drug. The duration of effects is from 8 to 12 hours. And with this treatment model, the treatment facilitators or therapists sit with the patient for the entire time. 8 to 12 hours is exhausting for the patient and for the treatment staff. But culturally, there's another reason why LSD has not been utilized, and that's simply because of its association with the political and cultural turmoil of the 1960s. So I think there was a an intention there, or at least in my mind, to distance ourselves from the controversies and the turmoil of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. So, of the four drugs you mentioned here, psilocybin and ayahuasca, I imagine, are the naturally occurring ones, and then MDMA and LSD are synthetic in origin. Is that correct?
Right. Well, now LSD, actually, analogs of LSD can be found in nature as fungi growing on a rye plant. So there is that. MDMA, though, is entirely a synthetic phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And Don Lattin, let me bring you into this conversation. I'm very interested in the history of these drugs, particularly the naturally occurring ones. I mean, how far back in time have humans been using psilocybin and ayahuasca?
Well, there's a long history, of course, among indigenous people, Native Americans, both in North America and South America, using sacred plant medicines like peyote and magic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, and ayahuasca, which is brewed from two plants native to the Amazonian basin. So there's a long history, I mean hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and not just, also in the old world, in Greece, all over Russia, there's a long history of this. Often, it was a shamanic and a spiritual ritual, acts of divination. The shaman would take these plants and have visions and to try to help people in their lives. So there's a very, very long history, and one of the interesting things that's going on now, in addition to the clinical trials that that Charlie down at UCLA is working on and others, there's a whole renaissance of people going down to South America to experience these medicines in their natural environment, in the jungles of Peru and South America. And then there are also churches in the United States, Brazilian churches, that sort of missionary outposts in the United States, where they can legally use ayahuasca in their communion, in their religious rituals. So there's two denominations that have churches, including one in the Bay Area here, where congregants can legally have psychedelic communion in their regular Sunday, in this case it's actually Saturday night, services. So there's that long tradition of shamanic and spiritual use. And then, of course, there's also a long tradition, not as long, of clinical trials involving these substances, as Charlie briefly mentioned. I mean, this really began, the first wave of the modern scientific research really began immediately after LSD was first synthesized in 1943 by a Swiss chemist named Albert Hofmann. And there were hundreds of studies and thousands of research subjects were given these drugs, and had very successful outcomes in terms of treatment for alcoholism, depression, anxiety. So there's a long history in both the therapeutic and the spiritual use.
Well, and Don, what happened to change that scientific trajectory that we were on in the 40s and 50s to find some interesting results from applications of these
drugs?
Well,
even this thing called the 60s happened. As anyone who was around back then probably remembers, there was among the baby boomers, there was a huge wave of personal exploration and recreational use, spiritual use, some might even say abuse, of LSD, magic mushrooms, all this MDA, later MDMA, and so what happened is the government, mainly under the administration of Richard Nixon, started identifying this as part of the whole youth counterculture, the anti-war movement, the peace movement, and the war on drugs. In some ways, it was a war on some drugs, and there were political decisions as part of that. So there was a real crackdown both on personal use. People forget that LSD was legal until 1966. And so there was a crackdown on both personal use of psychedelics, but also on university research at medical centers. So there was the government stopped funding this research, and universities became very gun shy about approving research projects. Now, part of this is because of a Harvard University psychologist named Timothy Leary, who was a brilliant psychologist at Harvard in the early 60s. I wrote a book called The Harvard Psychedelic Club about Leary and three other guys who came together at Harvard. And their research project kind of spun out of control in various ways. And Leary and his colleague there, Richard Alpert, who would move on to become Ram Dass, kind of became the high priests of the psychedelic counterculture of the 60s. And, you know, a lot of people will blame Leary for the backlash, but it's a much more complicated story than that. Also, you know, the CIA was involved in and the U.S. Army was involved with a lot of nefarious research into LSD and other psychedelics in the 50s and early 60s, and there was that news about that came out in the 70s, and so there was also a backlash against that. So, and there was also a tightening up of safety requirements for clinical trials involving human subjects. I mean, the rules were a lot looser for all kinds of research, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s. So there's a lot of reasons why there was this crackdown, but basically the research stopped from 1975 to the mid to late 90s. Mm-hmm. And Charlie was
early
one of the first, he was really a pioneer in this second wave.
Two, I believe.
Well, yeah, and Dr. Grubb, I wanted to bring you back into this, as picking up where Don just left off here. So this all stopped in the 70s, but then, as you just were starting to say, in the early 90s, we sort of have a renewed interest and a comeback of a sense with these drugs and medications. So can you explain what happened in the early 90s to
actually more than two decades of really no clinical research activity, an investigator at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, Rick Strassman, got permission to do a phase one study with normal volunteers looking at the range of effects of dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. The following year, our group at Harvard-UCLA Medical Center got permission to do a phase one with MDMA, and the year after that, Deborah Mash at the University of Miami, her group received permission to work with ibogaine, a West African it's a drug derived from a West African plant that's been used as an addiction interrupter. So, you know, we demonstrated in the early 90s that it was possible to work with the regulatory agencies, that they treated us fairly and objectively. They helped us actually optimize our protocols, and we were able, within academic institutional settings, able to conduct these studies, which then, I think, set the groundwork for the more robust clinical treatment studies that have been underway since the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. First with Roland Griffiths actually did a study at Hopkins looking at the at how psychedelics under optimal conditions may reliably induce a powerful psycho-spiritual experience that can be a predictor for positive therapeutic change. And then Francisco Moreno at the University of Arizona did a pilot study looking at the effects of psilocybin in patients with severe refractory obsessive compulsive disorder. And in the early 2000s, our group initiated a study looking at the safety and efficacy of a psilocybin treatment model in patients with advanced cancer anxiety. We were treating the anxiety, not the cancer. I always like to clarify that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like a whole range of kind of mental health care needs that researchers were starting to experiment with. And I guess before we go too much farther, I should not assume that many listeners have a direct experience with any of these different drugs. So, Dr. Grubb, perhaps maybe you could just briefly summarize some of the differences between some of these drugs that we've been talking about,
right?
Psilocybin,
right?
Ayahuasca, MDMA, and maybe LSD if you feel like it's relevant.
Sure, sure. Well, psilocybin, the DMT that's present in ayahuasca, LSD, they're considered a part of a group called the classical hallucinogens. And they've been explored, most of them explored, starting in the 50s through the 60s and interrupted, at least in modern medical settings, until the 90s, and they were the object of much of the early study. MDMA, which has some unique features and has chemically a chemical structure similar to both the classic hallucinogen mescaline and amphetamine, has a bit more of a stimulant action, facilitates articulating feelings, very good for people who are alexithymic, without words for feelings, and also has the capacity under optimal controlled settings to facilitate the emergence of strong feelings of empathy, mm-hmm. Which are very valuable in a therapeutic context.
Yeah, and let me bring Don Latin in on this question too. I'm just curious, you know, as you go around, talking about your book and your other research on this, how you sort of describe in lay terms the effects of these drugs. I mean, what is it like, you know, in a short, concise way to take some of these drugs?
Yeah, well, I think one of the important things to remember is that these drugs are very different than other drugs that are used in psychiatric medicine, like traditional antidepressants like Prozac or antipsychotics. It's really not the drug that's having the impact as much as the personal insight or the spiritual experience that is occasioned by the medicine. So it's a really a whole different dynamic going on here. And that's why, preparation is very important with the therapist to understand what your intention is and to talk about some of the issues that you're having in your life, whether it's around depression or addiction or a traumatic event in the past. And then, because often, I've seen videos of these 6-7 hour therapy sessions, and I actually personally experienced some myself as part of my research. Often the therapist is very hands off. I mean, the person is having an internal experience. We haven't really described how it works. I mean, they'll be laying on a sofa or a bed. A room looks kind of like a comfortable living room, and they'll have eye shades on and be listening to evocative music. And so the therapist in some ways is not doing too much during the actual experience, but then the person will come out of it, talk about it, process it in various ways. So, and the drugs, as Charlie was getting at, are different. I mean, MDMA, some people call it an empathogenic. It does really produce feelings of empathy and compassion. And if you're having trouble talking about, a lot of the research around trauma has been done with returning Iraqi and Afghan war vets who are dealing with the horrific things they experienced in the war, or with rape victims. And people, it sort of melts people's fear away and that lets them process these events and talk about them in a new way. And some of the other more classic psychedelics like psilocybin, magic mushrooms, it seems to me what it does is it's sort of a dissolution of the ego. It sort of occasions a new way of looking at both yourself and the rest of the world. People talk about sort of ego dissolution and connecting with this kind of bigger I, the little I, the mental chatter, the egotistical mind that's always kind of rattling on. That can quiet down and other things can come up. And that's why people often, you talk to people who are not religious or spiritual at all, who are part of these clinical trials, or people who are there's a whole underground therapy movement too. People are often, I'm someone who wrote about religion and spirituality for 30 years at the San Francisco Chronicle, and people are really having what would sound like classic spiritual religious experiences. I mean, a sense of wonder and awe and gratitude and transcendence. Very, very powerful feelings of love and compassion. And it almost sound hokey at times, but it's a very powerful experience, especially for people that have never experienced it, who are so-called psychedelically naive. Mm-hmm. It can be a very, very powerful experience and just change your way of looking at yourself and your problems and can be very transformative.
Well, I definitely want to get more into how these sessions work. And Dr. Grobe, on this subject, what kind of qualifications do you have to be able to administer these drugs for patients? Do you have to be a medical doctor? Is it enough to be just a PhD therapist, or does it not matter?
Well, certainly in the approved studies over the last couple of decades, there have been... MDs involved, as well as PhDs and also individuals with other kinds of professional credentials. I think it is important to have a professional license in one of the health fields, and both MDs and PhD psychologists certainly have played an active role.
So it ultimately sounds like it's up to the federal government to give permission, depending on qualifications.
Well, it's up to the federal regulatory agencies to approve the protocols that have been submitted, and part of that process, they're also assessing the institution and the personnel. But I think they're focused very keenly on the quality of the protocols and provisions to ensure safety of subjects and honestly security of and safety of the stored drug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, at the same time, though, Ethan, I mean, some of the best therapists, the actual therapists doing this work, don't necessarily have any real professional qualifications. They could be this one woman who I profile in my book, Mary Cosimano, who was a Catholic school teacher and counselor, who was a friend of one of the researchers at Johns Hopkins, and she's led probably more sessions than anyone, and these are the government approved, you know, clinical trials. So there is a kind of an art to this too. I think Charlie's right that you need to have institutional oversight and medical supervision, but some of the actual therapeutic work, there's really an art to it. The art of kind of deep listening.
Sure. So that's helpful. And I do want to get more into the mechanics of this, but first I want to invite listeners to join in. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing psychedelics and their potential application to mental health care in the U.S., and we're joined by Dr. Charles Grobe, professor in the departments of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine, and one of the country's leading clinical researchers of psychedelic-assisted therapy. And we're also joined by Don Lattin, author of Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments, and the New Psychotherapy. He's also former longtime religion writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. We do want you to call in with your questions or comments, and the phone lines are open now. Do you think that psychedelics should be legalized? Why or why not? Have you been treated formally or informally with one of these substances for addiction, depression, anxiety, or PTSD? And if so, what happened? The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page as well. So, Don, just to go back to you, you mentioned briefly PTSD and what that session is like, and I've read some interesting accounts of people who suffer from PTSD and how these drugs may be useful to them. Are there any specific stories that you want to share that maybe really kind of crystallize how the process works?
Well, the first chapter of my book, Changing Our Minds, is titled Wounded Warrior, and it's a very detailed account of one Iraqi war veterans, Nigel McCurry is his name, his treatment for PTSD from some of the trauma that he experienced in the early years in the war in Iraq. And this is someone who, you know, was discharged and was actually intentionally misdiagnosed by the Marines and the VA. There was a whole scandal around them not really acknowledging PTSD in kind of the early years of the war then. And he was given all kinds of other psychiatric medications, which only made things worse. His whole life fell apart. He was personal relationships with his girlfriend, his family, just crumbled, got into drinking, heavy drinking, and he was, you know, close to suicide. And his sister, I think it was, heard about these clinical trials going on in Maryland, sponsored by a group called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS. And he did this there. He was accepted as one of the participants in this clinical trial. And he talks about, in my book, he talks about how he feels like he was cured of PTSD. A lot of other people use that word, cured, because of this therapy. And it's a subtle thing in some ways. You know, he said that he would describe it like when he was on the MDMA, it allowed him to have an aerial view of his mind, and kind of he could see how his own mind was working and processing or not processing this trauma. And it just kind of elevated him out of his normal mode of thinking and gave him a new understanding of what was happening. And then working with two trained therapists, he was able to, you know, process these memories and file them away like people normally would file away memories. And, you know, I think it's been, what now, 3 or 4 years at least, and he's still doing fine. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to lots of other people who are involved in these clinical trials, and that's one of the amazing things. I mean, an experience, you take the drug once, maybe twice, or maybe the most three times, and you can have lasting change and a cure in your condition. So, and of course, it doesn't work for everyone like that, but that's just one example.
Sure. Well, let's hear from listeners. So we have on the line Paul from here in the Bay Area. Paul, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for having this discussion.
Yeah, no, glad you can join us. Do you have a question for our guests?
It's mostly a comment, but also a confirmation of some of the things you've been talking about. As a Navy veteran, I just found myself needing to process things, and I attempted that in different ways, and I had a psilocybin experience in nature, which I think is a classic way to do it, and it was so beautiful, and it really helped me, and I think that it's almost something that humans should do in their life as a way to move forward in life, and so I just, it's mostly that comment, and I've had some LSD experiences once or twice, and I just think both substances would be hard to abuse. They don't lend themselves well to abuse, and I just want to kind of leave it with that.
Great. Well, thank you, Paul, for sharing that. And Dr. Grobe, you probably hear comments like this from people who basically, you know, do this in a sort of underground, informal kind of way. What is your response when you hear about stories like what Paul just shared?
Well, he has a very interesting account to convey to us. You know, my work has been entirely focused on working within the institutional setting, but I'm very receptive to case reports from outside, and certainly these are these compounds have great potential to facilitate healing, great potential to reconnect individuals to nature. Taking it in a natural setting with proper supervision, there should be someone with this individual who is straight, who could address any unexpected occurrences which may show up, but it can kind of reconnect an individual to nature and also to the arc of one's life, to kind of reaccess kind of a sense of one's true identity and renew a sense of meaning and a renewed purpose to their lives. So one can hear very impressive stories. On the other hand, things can go off the rails. You know, if vulnerable individuals take this under suboptimal conditions, unfortunate effects can arise. So one has to be very, very careful. And if one is embarking on having this experience, one needs to take proper safety precautions and take this very, this is very, very serious medicine. You know, it's not a trivial medicine, and its use should not be trivialized. But when taken seriously with proper safeguards, it does have remarkable potential to facilitate healing.
So some good notes of caution there. And, Paul, I appreciate you sharing that story. Let's go back to the phone lines to Glenn from Berkeley. Glenn, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a comment and then a question, I guess. The comment is, I've done a lot of traditional therapies over the years, and, in fact, even studied at graduate level for a little while, and nothing was really making the shift. And I've tried different things, and I was actually in Peru for an ayahuasca San Pedro thing recently. But what I found the most helpful lately is I've been doing a microdose, maybe once every 5 days, and I've been doing it for about 3 months now. And I feel that at some level, and this is more to the question then, I feel like my brain is rewiring in a good way. I feel like actually decrystallizing all that. The patterns in my brain are decrystallizing, and I'm creating new patterns. And I'm wondering, with all the new brain scan imaging that people can do and all that, is there a way to actually, you know, get a baseline reading and then go in every month or every 3 months and actually see if the brain is looking different? Because that's how it feels to me. I feel like I'm rewiring the circuits.
Thank you for that that question. Dr. Grobe,
yeah, sure.
Is there so brain changes?
Microdosing is very, very interesting. This involves taking a dose of a psychedelic, either LSD or psilocybin mushrooms, but taking a dose that presumably is sub-threshold, that will not yield any psychoactive effects, where individuals can go about their activities during a a normal day. And the reports we're getting on the effects out in the world of people who are microdosing are very impressive. A very well-known writer named Ilette Waldman published a book that was well-received on the positive effects. This has really stimulated a lot of interest. Unfortunately, there have been no rigorous controlled research studies to date. So at this point, it's still in the realm of anecdote, but it's looking good, and there are plans underway, from what I've heard, to conduct the necessary prospective research study that will tell us whether or not microdosing is a real phenomena or just a placebo effect. In regards to the effects on the brain, certainly what your caller suggested about periodic brain imaging can help to determine if there's any neuroplasticity occurring. Brain imaging is a very exciting area that's going through rapid evolution and has started to focus in on some of the rather remarkable and unique effects that psychedelic compounds have on the brain. Also, preclinical studies working in the laboratory with cell culture or in laboratory animals is also finding evidence of what appears to be healthy change in brain function and even structure.
Yeah, people talk. This is Don Lattin. People talk about increases in creativity and cognitive functioning with microdosing, and it is difficult to separate out the placebo effect from something that's kind of this subtle. And it really it's a shame there hasn't been more serious clinical trials, double blind, placebo controlled studies for this kind of psychedelic treatment, as opposed to the full dose psychedelic session, where the double blind model is in some ways a little bit silly, because everyone knows if you've gotten a real dose of psilocybin or MDA or a placebo, but not so much with the microdose. You shouldn't be able to tell. So I think there are some studies that are just getting going with the Beckley Foundation in England, and I think Hefter Research Institute is
there are studies
trying to get something going.
So it sounds like for LSD maybe microdosing is something that is an area that could be more fruitful for research. And I just want to let listeners know this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the future of psychedelics, and we're joined by Dr. Charles Grobe, professor in the departments of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine, and Don Lattin, author of Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments, and the New Psychotherapy. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. That number is 1-866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. So we have an email question from Anne, who asks, under what circumstances can people try these types of therapies? Are they allowed under current laws? And a similar comment from Holly, who asks, where does a person who's profoundly intrigued in this and wants to be part of a clinical trials, where do they start? And Holly here is in Canada and wants to know how she can get into this. She sees it as an amazing way to naturally treat one of the most severe mental health issues in both countries of the U.S. and Canada. So, Don Lattin, what do you tell people who approach you and say, I want to get involved in this? Where do I start?
Well, it's a little tricky. I mean, the good news is if you're talking about getting included in a clinical trial, there is a big expansion just about starting right now on the treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder using MDMA. And they're in the so-called Phase 3 trials, where there are sites all across the country where they're doing this work. So people can go to the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies website, which is maps.org, and track that down. There's also the Hefter Research Institute. They're doing clinical trials involving psilocybin and depression. They started out just dealing with people with a life-threatening diagnosis, cancer patients treating the depression or the end-of-life anxiety from that. But now they're expanding that into other people who are suffering from treatment-resistant depression. So, of course, you have to qualify for the clinical trial, and it's quite a process. So the good news is it's usually free. There is one other medicine. There's some interesting work being done in, which is ketamine, which is not a Schedule I. It's medical doctors are able to use ketamine, and there's a couple different protocols for using ketamine for the treatment of depression, and there's some interesting research on that. And it's not a classic psychedelic, but taken in the right context at the right dose, it can definitely have an effect that's similar to a psychedelic experience.
All right. Well, thank you for that information, and we could talk a little bit more at the end about the future, policy-wise, of where all this might go. But in the meantime, I want to go back to the phones, and Parker from San Mateo is standing by. Parker, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is for both experts, and you might not be able to answer it. This pertains mainly to LSD, but I guess all these drugs in general. Is therapeutic-wise and health benefit-wise, obviously there is some benefit. Is there a cap limit where, you know, after 50, 60 doses of LSD, that there starts to become negative effects where it overrides the positive effects?
Mm-hmm. Right. So thank you.
And also for the record, I believe ketamine is a dissociative class of drugs. Thank you, bye.
All right. Well, thank you, Parker, for that question. I think it's a really important one. What are the limits to the health effects here? I mean, what should we be worried about? Dr. Grobe, do you want to respond?
I think for many people, excessive use is a potential problem. And, you know, what I've learned over many years is that sometimes too much of a good thing is not a good thing. So with repeated use, particularly using it under adverse circumstances, perhaps mixing with other drugs or alcohol, then problematic effects can occur. Now, that being the case, some individuals will regale you with stories about their hundreds of experiences. But you know, each individual is different. It may be how we metabolize the drugs impacts our capacity to tolerate them, and perhaps those who use it on a more regular basis without too much difficulty are fast metabolizers, rapid metabolizers, and those who are more subject to potential adverse effects are slow metabolizers. I think, you know, and also getting back to the whole issue of using these drugs in a therapeutic context, it's important to point out that it may involve only one or two treatments of the active drug within the context of an ongoing psychotherapy, including both preparation, monitoring during the experience, and integration afterwards.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, Parker, for that question. Let's go to Omar here in San Francisco. Omar, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you for taking my call. I have mental disorders in the family, including schizophrenia and bipolar. I mean, personally, I was with the U.S. military overseas for 6 years. So when I came back, I was dealing with a very bad form of depression. I wasn't sure if the source of my depression is a mental disorder or is it PTSD. I also saw a therapist. They told me that if the source of your depression is a mental disorder, medication like Zoloft and Prozac, etc., is counterproductive. So I've heard a lot of good things about mushroom and LSD, and I wanted to know how would that interact with your depression if you also have a mental disorder.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, question I'd like to direct to Don Latin. Don, what's your response to Omar?
Well, I think possibly Dr. Grobe might be better answering that question. But in terms of schizophrenia and bipolar, I think there's often people. I think Charlie's, and you have to be careful with people who have that history. Sometimes,
right. I think those are contraindications for participation in a psychedelic treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe not a good candidate then for this kind of treatment?
Yeah, I think there could be some risk involved here.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that response. And Omar, thank you for dialing in with that question. William from Albany is on the line as well. William, welcome to City Visions.
Hey, this is William.
Hi, and, William. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right. I did it back in the day, you know, a lot. You know, I'm 71 years old now, and I haven't had it for years. And I had a health event a couple of years ago that caused me to develop extreme peripheral neuropathic pain in my feet. And I'm wondering if this could be in any way helpful for that.
Okay, so thanks for that question, William. Maybe Dr. Grobe, back to you on this.
So, offhand, I can't think of any reports treating neuropathic pain. However, there were some interesting studies conducted back in the 60s, particularly an internist named Eric Cass in Chicago, who was a specialist in pain control, who found that just in general, so at least certain kinds of pain did respond to a psychedelic treatment, that it alleviated the intensity of the pain for a period of time and also reduced the need for narcotic pain medications. Now, this is not to say that this is an accepted indication. The current studies, our study at Harvard UCLA and LA Biomed, as well as the Hopkins and the NYU studies, did not find a strong association with pain reduction. Nevertheless, it's certainly an area that merits further exploration.
Mm-hmm. All right, well,
ketamine, I'll say, by the way, I've seen that utilized for chronic pain with some success.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, William, for that that question. And this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing the future of psychedelics and mental health care tonight with our guest, Dr. Charles Grobe from UCLA School of Medicine, and Don Latin, author of Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy, also former longtime religion writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. The phone lines are open if you have questions for our guests. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Dr. Grobe, wanted to go back to you with this. We had a caller who sounded like there was a contraindication, and that's actually a question that one of our listeners had from Timothy, who asks, what are some of the contraindications to this therapy that would preclude someone from participating in these types of therapies? And perhaps, Dr. Grobe, as part of that, you could describe a little bit of your own experimentations in the clinical setting with these
right,
drugs
yeah.
and patients.
So I tend to err on the side of caution. So I think, you know, some of my colleagues may be a little more daring, but in my mind, one has to be very careful about cardiovascular disease, particularly untreated hypertension. That's especially the case with MDMA. When we did our phase one MDMA studies back in the early mid-90s, we found that at higher dosages, some individuals are exquisitely sensitive to very significant elevations in blood pressure, which can potentially be very dangerous, even catastrophic. Another contraindication would be a problem, you know, liver disease, problems with metabolizing the drug. Also, individuals that we mentioned earlier with very, very severe history of psychiatric illness, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, if that's an accurate diagnosis, one has to approach these individuals with some hesitancy. Also, access to personality disorders can be very, very challenging, and I think some would say contraindicated in this kind of treatment.
And another thing I think to watch out for, and I know you're concerned about this, Charlie, is if you're going down to South America to try ayahuasca, it's not a good idea perhaps to be on the traditional antidepressants
you
do that, right?
Excellent point, Don.
Yeah.
So, yeah, back in the 90s, along with my colleague from Finland, Jace Calloway, we published an article on potential adverse interactions between ayahuasca and SSRI antidepressants. That individuals on this is the Prozac class drugs. Individuals on Prozac or Paxil or Zoloft or one of those drugs who take ayahuasca are at risk of developing a very serious clinical condition called a serotonin syndrome. So we've put the word out about that, and I think from what I've heard, many of these groups now caution their participants about that interaction.
And Dr. Grobe, do you want to talk about some of your promising experiments that you've had with patients in these drugs?
Oh, sure. So along with my colleague Alicia Danforth, we've finished and now have our paper under review, a study using an MDMA treatment model in autistic adults with social anxiety, with severe social anxiety, targeting the social anxiety, not targeting the autism per se. And, you know, that we haven't published our results yet. It's under review, but I can say, I think readers, when they do see our report will appreciate that there were some, you know, positive clinical, you know, findings there. We also, you know, have studied a psilocybin treatment model in individuals approaching the end of life with severe, you know, advanced cancer, and had some very impressive responses there, as did the Johns Hopkins group and the NYU group, that individuals, particularly those, this is consistent with research from the 60s with Stan Grof and Walter Pankey, with individuals who had, during the course of their many-hour-long psychedelic treatment session, had a powerful psycho-spiritual epiphany. These individuals, it turned out, were most likely to have you know, a positive clinical outcome in regards to improved mood, lessened anxiety, lessened demoralization, renewed sense of meaning and purpose in one's life, enhanced relatedness with family and close friends. So we as well as my colleagues at Hopkins at NYU have been very impressed with using this treatment model in a palliative medicine setting.
And Don Lattin, you talked a little bit about some of the process involved here, but I'd love it if you could describe for listeners how it works, you know, for the average person going into these clinicals. What's the process like?
Well, you know, I had a little bit of personal experience with that. You know, I wasn't able to get into a clinical trial, but I did do a session, for instance, with an underground psilocybin therapist, where she followed kind of a basic model that they have in the clinical trials. You know, I met with her. I was doing this both as a journalist, but also for my own personal growth, insight, and to deal with some issues in my life. And there is this underground therapy scene very active in the Bay Area, but all around the country. And you know, some of these people are very skilled and qualified without any credentials. There are, of course, you know, always there's charlatans out there. You've got to be very careful, and you get personal recommendations from people. But I write about this at the end of the book, and I met with this woman and had a kind of a preparatory interview, and then we decided to work together. And what happened with me is I had several people, some very close friends, die. And I was kind of dealing with issues of grief, and so during the psilocybin session, I, you know, had a very, very powerful, you know, kind of wailing, grieving, you know, crying, cathartic experience to deal with some of these surges of death with some close friends and family in my life in recent years. And it was very healing for me, because I'm, you know, kind of one of these guys that doesn't cry easily, and I got involved in organizing memorial services and, you know, doing all the stuff you have to do when someone close to you dies, but I hadn't really emotionally dealt with this loss. And I had a very powerful experience with this therapist and with the psilocybin, and it was very helpful and very healing. So I thought it was important for me, you know, as a journalist, to experience these medicines in as close as I could get to the clinical context of the clinical trial, you know, to understand how this works, because there's something about this. It's, you know, people talk about these experiences being ineffable. I mean, they're beyond words. They're so difficult to describe and understand. So I wanted to, you know, but once you take them, I mean, your own personal issues and life experiences come up. So it was a very interesting experiment for me as a journalist to go through this.
Well, certainly a lot of compelling personal stories like yours. And Dr. Grob, I have to ask, as you're, you know, the clinician here is assembling all these stories, how are the results being met? It seems like you're getting a lot of positive findings here. You know, how is it going over with different communities of people, and what's the basic response been?
Well, I think for quite some time, we really worked on staying under the radar and just, you know, quietly getting our protocols approved, raising the necessary funding and conducting our studies and publishing them in the leading journals and speaking at professional meetings. Now, in the last couple of years, news about what's going on has expanded greatly, and now there are a number of other groups get you know, kind of expressing an interest. to start their own psychedelic studies. Some new, very impressive studies are being conducted. A really good study at NYU with Michael Bogenschutz treating alcoholics. Another study at the University of Alabama with Peter Hendricks treating cocaine and crack addicts, with getting very good preliminary results. So I'd say, so far at least, the reception has been very positive. To an increasing degree, our professional colleagues are recognizing what we're doing, and they're seeing a potential value. They're also comparing this treatment model to conventional treatment models, which are often lacking in their durability and efficacy. So I think there's a growing interest to explore some new and novel models, which actually turn out to be amongst the oldest models known to mankind. It's rather ironic, but in the end, it's going to boil down to handling these compounds responsibly and utilizing optimal safety parameters to ensure health and well-being of subjects.
All right. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have a few people standing by here. Kelly from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, hi. I was calling, it's not about a psychedelic, but I have severe depression and mania, bipolar, and I've been using amphetamines during my severe downside just so I could function normally. And I was wondering if there's been any studies on that.
All right. Well, thank you, Kelly, for that question. Let's see, Don Latin or Dr. Grobe, do either one of you know if amphetamines are part of this?
Well, I mean, stimulants are commonly used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Years ago, really before the advent of modern psychopharmacology, I think patients with severe depression were treated with amphetamine. But I think over time, that has fallen out of practice, and I think there's some concern that amphetamines carry their own relative risks. And so I would say that's not a conventional use of amphetamine in today's world.
All right. Well, thank you, Kelly, for that question. Let's go to Philip from Brisbane. Philip, welcome. It sounds like we don't have Philip, but Mary Louise from Palo Alto. Welcome to City Visions.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes. I have a kind of a funny little question. I come from Sweden, and in Sweden, the red mushroom, which I ought to know the name of, with little white dots all over it, we were always warned, you don't eat that, you don't touch that, da da da. We were allowed to pick about 7 different kinds of mushrooms, but not that one. And since then, I have heard that it has psychedelic effects, and I haven't found one, so I can't try it out. But I wondered if you might know something you could tell me.
Okay, let's see, Dr. Grobe?
Yeah, so Amanita muscaria was used traditionally in Siberia, in northerly latitudes, as a drug for healing and divination. And but it does have some level of toxicity. It's a different kind of hallucinogen than the psychedelics. It has a kind of a range of cholinergic effects that can be somewhat problematic. So you'll not hear of a recreational use of Amanita muscaria, and in fact, you really will not hear much at all about it outside of accounts from the past of Siberian shaman.
Huh. All right. Well, thank you for the question. Let's go to Susanna from Sebastopol. Susanna, what's your question for the panel?
Hi there. Great show. Thank you so much for airing this. So I'm curious, since you're having such great results with very few doses, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, maybe just 1 or 2, you think there might be some blowback from the drug companies who are invested in creating drugs that people take every day, maybe for their entire life. How would this materialize, we don't need those anymore. We can just take 1 or 2 trips and, you know, it's going to have much more significant effects.
Yeah, no, great question, Susanna. Yeah,
this has always been a concern of mine. And one of the reasons why we kind of tried to stay under the radar, not to raise the interest of the pharmaceutical giants who actually make their profits off of drugs that need to be administered on a daily basis for weeks, for months, sometimes for years. Here you're talking about a one or two treatments. Your caller raises a concern, and only the future will allow us to see how this is going to play out. But there is some concern that the pharmaceutical giants may see this as undesirable competition.
There's really had to rely on private funding. The researchers have had to rely on private funding.
Don Lattin, that's a really important point. That's a question I wanted to ask you. We just have a couple minutes left here. What you see as the path forward now? We're having some promising results, politically speaking, policy-wise. What are the challenges in the way? What needs to be done for those who would like to see more medical research with these?
Well,
drugs?
You know, some people were concerned that with the incoming Trump administration, you know, that there would be a crackdown on this research. And, but Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General. He's an anti-pot crusader. But actually what's happened is, my understanding is that nothing has really slowed down in terms of the federal regulatory process. It's the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, which is really the key agency here. And ironically, you know, the Trump administration wants to create a business-friendly environment, so they want to make it easier for big pharma to bring drugs to market, and that might have a kind of a positive effect on the psychedelic research, and that it could even be easier for them to get approval if they can show that these drugs are safe and effective. So far, correct me if I'm wrong, Charlie, there hasn't really been any indication there's been any slowdown under the Trump administration.
No, there hasn't. And I found over time, including in over the last year or two, that people at the FDA and the DEA have been very good to work with. They've been very helpful. They've been, you know, there has not been any problems that, let's say, older colleagues from the 60s will reflect upon.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Grobe, if you had one policy ask of someone in a position of power at the federal government, what would you like to see change in terms of how we do policy around these drugs?
Well, I'd like to see some acknowledgement that there may be some value to spurring on some of our studies, particularly working with individuals in a palliative medicine setting who are approaching the end of life, and we're observing that individuals provided this treatment can have remarkably positive psychological and psychospiritual change. Now, the other area that we haven't really touched upon, which I think is very important, is the utility of a psychedelic treatment model for alcohol abuse. You know, one of the most notoriously difficult conditions for modern medicine to treat, going back to even the late 50s and Humphrey Osmond, and the 60s with Groff and his colleagues, there were some. And more recently, with Bogenschutz, there's some very powerful data pointing to a very effective treatment model that the government should, I think, put more resources into. One problem has been now it's all the funding has come from private sources. There has been very little public sector funding made available. That's what I'd like
to
see changed.
Sounds like we have a long list of policy barriers and medical treatments that we could use these promising treatments for. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. And my guests were Dr. Charles Grobe of UCLA School of Medicine and Don Lattin, author of Changing Our Minds and former longtime religion writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you both for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week for another City Visions show. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.